From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We talk a lot about saints in this program, and of course we are always excited when there are American saints, who are those people who have walked amongst us, who are raised to sainthood. Well, believe it or not, there's a canonization cause which you might not even have heard of, because it really only got off the ground in 2018, following Pope Francis's new path to sainthood, Oblatio Vitae, the free will offering of one's life for another. And there is a martyrdom cause which relates to that, and it's called the Shreveport Martyrs. They were priests who died caring for people afflicted by the 1873 yellow fever epidemic in Shreveport, Louisiana. And all five were missionary priests from Brittany and France, and they came to serve the diocese there, and they're listed as potential saints now. And their cause for canonization is closing from the diocesan level, meaning it's moving to Rome. And joining us today will be Father Peter Mangum, the Episcopal delegate for that cause. He'll be talking to us about an incredible story of those five heroic men who gave up their lives out of love for others. And also joining us today will be Dr. Mary Soha, talking to us about the medical miracle that was used in the canonization of St. Kateri Tekakwitha. Just this past week, the Native American Saint, St. Kateri, was her feast day was celebrated. But what about that miracle that was declared some years ago? We'll be talking to her about that later in the show. And later in the program, we'll be looking at the might-be saint of the day. So for today's day, we've got Blessed Stefano del Lupo, who died in 1191 in Italy. And the 365 Days with Mary project for today is Our Lady of the Miracle from Lima in Peru in the year 1630. And the question of the week, what does nihil obstat mean related to Marian apparitions? It's trickier than you might think. And the miracle of the day, Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal from July 19th, 1830, one of the biggest Marian apparitions in history. We'll talk about that later in the show. Take a look at the miracle news. We had pretty big miracle news this week. The Vatican actually approved the Marian devotion in Slovakia, but doesn't recognize those apparitions as authentic. This relates to the Litmanova, the place of Marian apparitions from the 1980s, I believe, early 90s, we might say. And this is a case where I've wondered for years, would the Vatican ever recognize it in any way? And of course, it had gone uncommented on for many years, despite there being some sort of a shrine there in Slovakia, and also some local devotion recognized by the local bishop. But we've never seen any kind of a statement coming out of Rome. Now, as of this past year, when they relax the standards, you might say, and they no longer declare anything supernatural in Rome, they've come out with this new label of nihil obstat, or this new application, nihil obstat, which is the highest level of recognition now that supernaturality is no longer considered. And so this was big news coming out that the Vatican recognized the pastoral value of the alleged apparitions of the Virgin Mary on Mount Zvir, near the village of Litmanova in northwestern Slovakia from 1990 to 1995. And this authorizes public worship, but it doesn't comment on the supernatural nature of the apparitions. So the Vatican's Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith granted a nihil obstat, that is, nothing stands in the way, of the Marian devotion surrounding the alleged apparitions of the Virgin Mary on Mount Zvir near the village of Litmanova in northwestern Slovakia. Again, did not comment on whether it's supernatural or not. In the letter, which was signed by the prefect for the dicastery, that's Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, and addressed to Archbishop Jonas Josef Maxim, he's from the Archeparchy of Bessarov of the Byzantine Rite Catholics, he recognized the pastoral value of this phenomenon and authorized public worship, but didn't comment on the supernatural authenticity of the apparitions. And the cardinal stated in this letter, which was public by the Vatican Dicastery, that discernment has taken into account the many spiritual fruits born from this phenomenon. And this decision responds to the former request by Maxim, who in letters sent to the Vatican in February and May highlighted the, quote, countless sincere and heartfelt confessions and conversions experienced by pilgrims, which continue to take place at the shrine despite the alleged apparitions ending 3 decades ago. And the Slovak prelate also highlighted the constant flow of pilgrims who have continued to come to the site, manifesting an experience of faith. And Fernandez noted several messages attributed to the Virgin that offer invitations to conversion, joy, and inner freedom. One of the most cited says, "Let Jesus set you free, let Jesus set you free, and do not allow your enemy to limit your freedom, for which Jesus shed so much blood. A soul that is free is the soul of a child." That was the message reported on December 5th, 1993. And so we see some ambiguities, however, in the messages. And the Dicastery recognized that some of the messages contain ambiguities or unclear formulations, such as one suggesting that nearly all people in one part of the world are condemned, or one part that says that that sin is the cause of all illness. And these messages have not been deemed adequate by the Dicastery for publication. However, the Cardinal later recalled that as early as 2011, a doctrinal commission dedicated to investigating these apparitions explained that the alleged visionaries did not hear messages in human language, but rather had inner experiences, I guess, locutions, that they attempted to translate, which I guess might explain certain inaccuracies or personal interpretations. And other Marian apparitions, we see Lourdes, Fatima, Guadalupe. The idea is that the visionary heard the voice of Mary. In this case, it seems that they were having the voices in their head. So perhaps that's a distinction, and one in which they allow for this nihil obstat, sort of saying that there might be some errors in the messages or things that could be open to human interpretation. But whatever it is, we see this as an approved, well, we see the devotion is approved, but the apparitions have not been said to be supernatural, which is says that they can be discerned, and people can go there in good faith to that site in Slovakia at Litmanova. So that is the big news coming out of the Vatican this week, the decision about the Litmanova apparitions. From 1990 to 1995, the Vatican has finally spoken. Let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week. We look at the trivia questions and give out an answer, and people will see if people have the right answer. The question from last week, we were talking about St. Margaret Mary Ellicott and the Sacred Heart. The question from last week was, who was the saintly spiritual director of St. Margaret Mary Ellicott? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com or questions@miraclehunter.com. Go to my website, send me a message that way. However you do it, send me a message. I get them all. And the person with the fastest answers can win their prize, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We're talking today about the Shreveport martyrs. So the question for today's trivia is, who is the most recent martyr from the United States who was beatified or canonized by Rome? The question is, who is the most recent martyr from the United States? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and we'll see if you have the right answer. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Father Peter Mangum, the Episcopal Delegate for the Cause for the Beatification of the Shreveport Martyrs. Big news, that cause is moving along to Rome. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show know that we love talking about saints and American saints at that, and even more so those who are on the path to sainthood from the United States. Well, we've talked about the Georgia martyrs and the North American martyrs, and we've talked about the martyrs of La Florida, who is one of the subjects of one of the very first episodes of They Might Be Saints. But there's another martyrdom cause that you might not be aware of, and that's the Shreveport martyrs that from Louisiana. And their cause is moving ahead from the diocesan phase to the Roman phase. So we might see some new saints from our Catholic Church here in the United States recognized at some point soon. We're so excited today to be joined by Father Peter Mangum, the Episcopal Delegate for the Cause for the Beatification of those Shreveport Martyrs. Welcome to the program today, Father Peter.
Thank you so much, Michael. Great to be with you.
Wonderful to have you here. And as I mentioned before, I think that on this show, we've talked a lot about the martyrs of La Florida and the Georgia martyrs, and perhaps those earlier martyrs, the North American martyrs. We've discussed that as well, but maybe not people don't know as well these martyrs from Louisiana. Tell us a little bit about who they were and why this is going forward for canonization.
In the 1800s, the new Diocese of Natchitoches, which is northern Louisiana, was founded by its founding bishop, Auguste Marie Martin, who was from Brittany, France. And at the time, he had only five priests for over 20,000 square miles. So he thought best to go back to his homeland of Brittany, France, and recruit people there. And indeed, he did. And they came to the northern Louisiana, which was very unchurched at the time. They weren't so much thinking about what's going to happen to me if I go there. But they were thinking, what's going to happen to the people if we don't? We need to get the good news of Jesus Christ to the people of northern Louisiana. So they came, and for a quick overview, they started ministry, which was not easy. In 1873, there was a yellow fever epidemic that took place in Shreveport, and it was the third worst in the United States history. And basically what happened was, one after the other, each of these priests entered into this quarantined area knowing that it would bring about a premature death. And so that's what they did. They freely gave of their lives and therefore are considered martyrs to their charity.
If I might interrupt you, let me ask the question, is this cause now under the category of oblatio vitae, the free will of giving up one's life for another, or is it a martyrdom clause, as we've seen, out of hatred of the faith? How is it categorized as Rome looks at it?
Right. The oblatio vitae, as you said, the free offering of their lives. So in 2017, Pope Francis wrote this motu proprio all about this particular new cause, this new path to canonization. And we had been considering doing something with regards to the priests, writing about them, making their heroic witness known, not only to the people of this area, but beyond. But we were finding some difficulty until Pope Francis wrote that motu proprio. And Then immediately following that, in July of 2017, we began all of our efforts, which have now led to what is considered the closing session of the diocesan faith.
Amazing. And as we see, this is an older cause. We might call it a historic cause from 1873. A lot of the causes that are considered more these days are the more recent ones. So an extra level of difficulty or challenge has to come into play when you're talking about the lives of people who lived a century ago. Talk about the challenges of working with a historic cause.
We have had to enter so many different archives throughout the United States, as well as in France itself, going to the dioceses where these priests were born and raised. We have found plenty of historic documentation, and also just the very fact that their fama sanctitatis, their fame of sanctity, of holiness, has continued here in the Diocese of Shreveport. So, for example, even 70 years after their death, five very beautiful stained glass windows were commissioned for the church in downtown Shreveport where they all died. Because the people remember, they still invoke their names. Even the city of Shreveport, which is definitely not considered a Catholic city, it's a very Christian city, but the people here recognized what they did because by going into this quarantined area, they were helping just the regular citizen, regardless of who he or she was, I mean, obviously, and gave their lives out of love for Jesus Christ and their fellow man. And so much so that, for example, one of the newest of the streets at that time, a major thoroughfare, was named after the founding pastor, Father Jean-Pierre, and it still has his name, that street. He was the first one to found a library in the city, made sure that education was given to everyone. And so it was, it's quite an historic feat because these priests helped make this city a very, as it were, Catholic friendly city, very ecumenical since almost its founding.
Amazing. We've been talking today with Father Peter Mangum, the Episcopal Delegate for the Cause for the Beatification of the Shreveport Martyrs. And as we reflect on that path to sainthood, Oblatio Vitae, this is different than normal martyrdom, as we might say, where it's in odium fidei, out of hatred of the faith, somebody has been killed. I believe in the Oblatio Vitae, you can't just have the offering of one's life. If someone pushed another person out of the way and then got hit by a car and they saved their life, that wouldn't necessarily propel them towards sainthood. They would have to be sort of a Catholic in good standing who's known for a life of virtue, correct? Their virtue has to be a part of the equation as well.
Their virtue very much has to be part of the equation. There's because when they put themselves in this position of a premature death, it's propter caritatem. It's all because of their love of God and neighbor. So there's a free offering, voluntary offer of life, and really this heroic acceptance of a premature, untimely death. I can't help but think that these young boys, then young men, and then later these missionaries to our part of Louisiana were so super familiar with all of the saints of France, of Brittany, who themselves had died premature deaths because of all they did during times of plagues, of epidemics, the Black Plague, that they had so many. We visited the five churches in which these priests were from and the baptismal fonts at which they were baptized. And in the churches, there are all these statues and paintings of so many of the saints, of the Holy Helpers, St. Blaise, etc., who died early because of their heroic witness. So I can't help but think that they're having been taught about these saints, and they prayed through their intercession, and then their time came, and they took it. They saw this as God's will. For example, one of the five priests, as he was leaving Natchitoches, which was the sea city at that time, the people were telling him, "No, please, please do not go. You go to your death." And he just replied, "I know I go to my death. It is the surest and shortest path to heaven." And so he got on horseback at that time, 4 days' journey to Shreveport, where he arrived just in time to anoint the priest who was dying of a yellow fever before him. And he, as it were, took the baton and kept going. Each one of the priests was anointed by the priest who followed. At no point was Shreveport left without the sacraments. There's another example of yet another of the priests who came from Monroe, Louisiana, and by stagecoach. He was one of those who was very much hated by the people early on. I mean, even the little kids were given permission to by their parents to pick up these little rocks, pebbles, throw them at the priest. They would spit at this priest, call him names. He built the first church, and then the city literally built a saloon right next to the church, a saloon and every aspect of that, from the Old West, as it were, and yet he became beloved. And when he got on the stagecoach ready to go to Shreveport, as I like to say, that was his final pulpit. He got up there, looked at the people who didn't want him to lead, and he said, "Please write to the bishop. I go to my death. It is my duty, and I must go." This is the witness. Of course, the word witness is martyr in the Greek, but this is the type of witness that they went in. As everyone was fleeing Shreveport, these priests entered Shreveport and made the ultimate sacrifice.
Amazing. And you have two big events coming up. One is the closing of the diocesan phase for this beatification process. And then you have a meeting with the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints coming up in October. Tell us a little bit about the closing of the process. I know they gather all the documentations and they put it in the box with the red ribbon and the wax seal, and they send it off to the Dicastery. Talk a little bit about that event, what's going to be happening and what it will signify with the closing of the phase.
All of the officials dealing with this diocesan phase of this canonization process met the first week of July, and literally on the 4th of July, we concluded all of our the procedures and the interviews and everything that we needed to do in order to finalize the diocesan phase. We produced over 5,500 pages of all the documents, and now in triplicate form, we will get this ultimately to Rome. We go by means of the nunciature in Washington, D.C., and we will get six banker boxes full of documents, because it's triplicate form, to the nunciature. The Cardinal Apostolic Nuncio, Christophe Pierre, has already said that he will transmit everything via diplomatic pouch to the Vatican. And but before that takes place, we gather at Holy Trinity Church in Shreveport on August 28th. It's going to be a big day in our diocese, because there are some finalities, formalities to close the diocesan phase. And so we'll have a special liturgy, and we will have the signing of various documents and the sealing of those red ribbons that you mentioned. With the red wax, we have a diocesan seal, and then they will be ready to be transmitted to the nunciature in Washington, D.C. And then, and that will take place in the month of September. We've already arranged for that to happen in September. And then the October 9th or 10th, Bishop Malone, the Bishop of the Diocese of Shreveport, and I will basically meet those documents at the Dicastery, and we will formally hand them over to the officials of that Dicastery for the Causes of the Saints. And my understanding is that literally when they cut the ribbon there in this very simple ceremony and giving us the receipt related to that they've received these documents, then the diocesan phase is concluded and the Roman phase begins. And of course, we're so hopeful that the Roman phase will ultimately declare these five priests venerable. And so that's our hope and prayer, and people are praying through the intercession of these servants of God that this indeed happens.
Wonderful. Well, it's an exciting bit of news, this closing of the phase and moving on to the Roman phase. And someday we could have five new people who live from the United States or in America as recognized as saints in our Catholic Church. What would it mean for the Diocese of Shreveport or Louisiana or the United States or the world, perhaps, if Isidore, Jean-Pierre, Jean-Marie, Louis, and Francois were someday recognized as blesseds and then saints in our Catholic Church?
This would mean, just so much. I mean, this is just actually unfathomable that five people from the same diocese in the United States would be recognized by Rome as venerable. And then, of course, at that time, we start praying fervently for the miracles to come. And the miracles is what will help them become beatified and then ultimately canonized. And so what we already, their cause is known in many places throughout the world. I mean, we have seen all sorts of articles in various languages, from German to Vietnamese to Italian, Spanish, all about these five priests. And of course, French, because we have a special rapport with the Bishop of Saint-Brieuc at Tréguay, Bishop Denis Moutel, who is the current bishop there, and he knows very well of this of the cause, and is following it. He knows that we are going in October to Rome. In fact, I've invited him to join us because they too are praying through the intercession of these servants of God. They translated the documentary, The Five Priests, into French. And so the people of that diocese know about this. And then the other wonderful providential aspect to this is that our apostolic nuncio is not only from France, he's from Brittany. And not just from Brittany, but the same very area that these five priests come from. So he knows their story very well. Personally, I have heard him tell others about the five priests with quite the detail. He has forwarded three of our books on related to these five priests. If I can put it this way, he's been one of our major cheerleaders in this cause. So I know that they're being declared venerable would have an unbelievable impact, not just in Louisiana and the United States, but worldwide.
Wonderful. Well, we'll be keeping our eyes on this cause and praying for it, for its success. And we're so grateful to you, Father Peter Mangum, the Episcopal Delegate for the Cause for the Beatification of the Shreveport Martyrs, for joining us on today's program.
And it's been my privilege. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for all that you do to help people know about these extraordinary people in the United States who have lived such heroic, virtuous lives.
Thank you, Father. And that was Father Peter Mangum joining us today, talking about the Shreveport Martyrs. For people who want to find out more information and to track this cause and find out how it goes from the closing of the diocesan phase to the opening of the Roman phase and beyond, people can go to the website shreveportmartyrs.org. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. What does Nihil Obstat mean when it refers to Marian apparitions? Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love to hear what people are thinking about. They send them to my email inbox, and I check them out, and I try to respond when I can. And some of those I select to be read on air, so send me a message that way. Or I really like answering questions in person, so I travel around to different Catholic parishes, shrines, or conferences, always talking about miracles, whether it's Eucharistic miracles or Marian apparitions or how the Catholic Church investigates the supernatural. I give a talk for about 45 minutes, and I love opening it up to questions and hear what people are thinking about. And sometimes that question and answer goes on for a while, but for me, it's just as fun as the presentation itself. So go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and click on the contact tab. You can send me a message that way, and maybe I'll be speaking at a parish in your area sometime soon. So the question for this week is a good one, and it's very appropriate, actually. It says, Dear Miracle Hunter, what does Nihil Obstat mean related to Marian apparitions? Thank you, Stephanie. Well, thanks, Stephanie, for your question. And this is a good one, and one that I find a little bit interesting or funny. Nihil Obstat, of course, is Latin, and we've referred to this numerous times on this show in particular, but also on past shows. Nihil Obstat means in Latin, nothing obstructs or nothing gets in the way. So when the Vatican release puts that label on something, whether it's a book or whether it's a Marian apparition or otherwise, it's trying to indicate that there's no obstacle to the faithful believing in it. And so that label is now put on Marian apparitions that are judged by the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, which previously, using the 1978 norms, could give this decision of constate supernaturalitate, established as supernatural, non constate supernaturalitate, not established, or constate non supernaturalitate, established as not supernatural. So this was the old way they did it. Now the new way is nothing can be declared supernatural anymore. There's no constate supernaturalitate anymore, but the highest level is nihil obstat. So nothing stands in the way. The devotion is encouraged. And to my understanding anyway, in the old days, when something said
nihil obstat, or when they made that judgment, they meant that there was absolutely nothing wrong with it. It was it had been perfected. There were no issues. There were no problems. However, in the new statements that come out of Rome related to Marian apparitions and other miracles, when they put the label nihil obstat on it, they almost should say quasi nihil obstat, almost nothing gets in the way, because once in a while, as in the case of Litmanova and in the case of Medjugorje, they've given approvals of nihil obstat, but have said, well, except for a couple of things that should be ignored. Might be personal interpretation of the visionary, or it might be some confusion in there, in which cases they extract or redact these items from the list of messages that are disseminated by the local bishop or otherwise. And so there's some recommendation that some of the messages might not be as perfect as the others. And so when they say nihil obstat, they mean mostly nothing stands in the way, I guess. But either way, the devotion's encouraged when they put that label on. But that's what the Latin phrase nihil obstat means. So thanks, Stephanie, for your question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com. And maybe I'll be answering your question on the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We've got Marian apparitions and devotions and other ways that Mary is honored all over the world for each and every day of the calendar year. You all know Fatima, May 13th, or Lourdes, February 11th, or Guadalupe, December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion from somewhere in the world that lines up exactly to the day's date. And so for today's date, July 19th, we've got Our Lady of the Miracle from Lima in Peru in the year 1630. And I was just in Lima a couple months ago. So Our Lady of Socueca from Spain is the devotion. And it's an image of the Immaculate Conception, and it was placed by the Franciscan friars in the first church in Lima from the conquest. And the image became known as La Misionera, where it accompanied the friars on missionary journeys. In 1536, during the rebellion in Cusco, the Inca capital, the natives trapped many Spaniards in a hut and set fire to the roof. When La Misionera was seen to be appearing in the sky with Santiago, St. James, all were saved and the fire coming to an end. In honor of that event, a church was built on the site. On November 27, 1630, an earthquake struck the city, but the image of Our Lady was said to turn to the Blessed Sacrament, and the earthquake stopped. On June 19, 1953, the miraculous statue was crowned by the Papal Nuncio, and the feast day is November 27th. And that is today's feast day, Our Lady of Socueca from Spain in 1808, or Our Lady of the Miracle from Lima in Peru in 1630. Let's take a look at the miracle of the day. We do this every week where we find a miracle that happened at some point in Christian history that lines up exactly to the day's date. Of course, today's date is July 19th, and the big miracle is the one of Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal. St. Catherine Laboure, a nun in France, woke up on July 19th, 1830, to the voice of the Blessed Mother, calling her to a chapel to pray. She instructed St. Catherine to have a medal made that would rain down graces on those who wore them. And inscribed on the medal is, O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for us who have recourse unto thee. And St. Catherine was canonized in the year 1947, but that is today's miracle of the day, Our Lady of the Miraculous Medal. Let's take a look at the sainthood news. We do this every week where we try to keep you up to date with the saints who are coming down the pipeline. But we talk about those servants of God, venerables, and blesseds before they have all their miracles and are acknowledged as saints by Rome. And of course, this lines up to my book, They Might Be Saints, which I think is my best one, available at EWTNRC.com. And also my television series on EWTN, They Might Be Saints, where we look at Americans on the path to sainthood. And so for sainthood news, last month, the Holy Father was received an audience by His Eminence Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Cause of Saints. And during this audience, the Supreme Pontiff authorized the same dicastery to promulgate the decree regarding the martyrdom of the servants of God, Manuel Izquierdo, a diocesan priest, and 58 companions of Jaén in Spain, killed between 1936 and 1938 out of hatred of the faith, in Odium Fidei, in different places in Spain, in the context of the same persecution. And it was carried out by revolutionaries moved by anti-religious and anti-Christian sentiments. They massacred numerous priests, religious, and lay people, desecrating and pillaging churches and places of worship and outraging the sacred objects. The odium fidei of the guerrillas, driven by atheist propaganda, is amply demonstrated by the general violence against the church, its ministers, and many of its faithful. That was the entry on the website for the Dicastery for the Cause of Saints related to Manuel Izquierdo Izquierdo and his 59 companions, who sainthood news for this week. And the might-be saint of the day, we always look to see someone whose death or feast day is lines up exactly to the day's date. We've got Blessed Stefano del Lupo, who died in 1191 in Italy, and he was born between 1099 and 1118. He was a Benedictine monk at the San Liberatore Monastery in Maiella Mountains of Abruzzo in Italy, and he was feeling a call to a life of penance. He became a hermit in a cave near the monastery. Now, legend says that he got the name Del Lupo, which translates to of the wolf. It was a nickname when he miraculously tamed an aggressive wolf in the wild area outside Montepello in Italy. I was there not too long ago. Like many other hermits, his reputation for holiness spread and attracted many would-be spiritual students to deal with him. He founded the San Pietro de Vallebona Monastery near Montepello, the house associated with the abbey state of Santa Maria de Pulsano. And for 40 years, Stefano served as a monk and spiritual director, leaving the administration of the house to a series of priors. However, in 1188, Pope Clement III issued a special privilege to the house, elevating it to an abbey, and he began his service as its abbot. And he died in Carovalli in Italy in the year 1191 on July 19th of natural causes. And that's today's Might Be Saint of the Day. With one miracle, Blessed Stefano del Lupo will be known as Saint Stefano del Lupo. And for people who want to check out my series, They Might Be Saints, you can go to EWTN.com. You can go to the On Demand tab there. Or you can also tune in on Sunday, July 20th at 1:30 p.m. Central Time. They Might Be Saints, Venerable Mother Maria Kalpis. And the cause for sainthood for Venerable Mother Maria Kalpis, the founder of the Sisters of St. Casimir, her inspirational work in education and health care led many to seek her intercession before God on their behalf. And that's They Might Be Saints, Venerable Mother Maria Kalpis, on July 20th at 1:30 p.m. Central Time. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mary Soha about the medical miracle used in the canonization for St. Kateri Tekakwitha. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. We've got so many American saints or people who lived in the area that would in the future become America. And the number of potential saints, I should say, is around 100. But the actual number of canonized saints in the United States is extremely small. And we're talking about a couple in Hawaii, St. Damien and St. Marianne Cope, and a number of others throughout the history of the Catholic Church. St. Theodora Guerin, for example, or St. I'm even drawing a blank on some of the other ones. there's so few. And so when we look at the canonizations in the United States, it's always an exciting thing. When Father Michael McGivney of the Knights of Columbus was beatified, he was the last person to have done so. And that was in October 31st of last year in Solanus Casey and a couple of martyrs we have. That's an exciting thing in the United States. And there's one saint her miracles are amazing, and I think there's such great pride for many people in the United States for her because of her unique background, and that is St. Kateri Tekakwitha. And her feast day is coming up on July 14th, so we're so excited today to talk about that great saint and some of the miracles that were used for her canonization. And we're so lucky today to be joined by Dr. Mary Soha. She was the medical consultant on some of those miracle investigations and that led to her beatification, and another miracle in the future happened, which led to her canonization. And we're so excited today to talk to Dr. Mary about those. Welcome to the program today, Dr. Mary.
Thank you so much.
Well, I know she's a saint who's very near and dear to your heart, and I think there are a lot of Americans who are excited about her because of her Native American background and sort of unique story. And perhaps she was the earliest person living in the region of the United States that would later become the United States to be canonized. So she holds a very special place in that way. And so when we talk about Saint Kateri Tekakwitha, talk about what is it about her that that people are so interested in?
Her simplicity and the beautiful development of her faith that took place within her whole being from a contemplative perspective. She was not baptized until she was 17, and she only had the presence of her mother, who was the Catholic presence in her life, until she was 4. Her mother died of smallpox along with her father and baby brother. But from the age of 4 until the age of 15, there was no religious missionaries. There was no real Christian presence in her life, except one other Christian Algonquin that had been captured as a slave along with her mother. And she continued to foster this belief in Jesus Christ, this prayer life that was so intense.
And how did her cause proceed after she died? I know that one of the very interesting things about her is she had smallpox and had a very scarred face as a result. But when she died, her body was said to those wounds were said to be healed. And so there were miracles that happened, and there were these interesting phenomena. But how did her fame of sanctity grow, or how did her reputation grow? She might be advanced as a saint.
Yes, 15 minutes after she died, it's chronicled in the Jesuit proceedings that all of the scars on her face and her body from the smallpox completely disappeared. Two French fur trappers were going by the Catholic mission the day of her death, and they looked in and they thought there was just this beautiful Indian princess who was just asleep. And when they were told that she had died, they immediately volunteered to make the casket for her. The blanket that she died in was kept, you know, as a sacred item by the shrine, by the mission there, and it was used on multiple occasions to wrap around other Native Americans who were ill or people who had been injured. And so many cures were attributed to Kateri's intercession starting shortly after her death.
That's amazing. We're talking today with Dr. Mary Soha about St. Kateri Tekakwitha, whose feast day is coming up July 17th. And she's a remarkable saint. She's got a very unique backstory and background. And I think many Americans are excited to have her amongst the very short list of saints from the United States. And she died in 1680, and her beatification was in 1980. So that's a full 300 years. That's a very long-running, I guess you might say, historic canonization cause. There are different reasons for that. Talk about the finding of the miracles, and that's necessary. When she's declared venerable, then miracles can be actually officially brought forward to Rome,
right,
as to possibly move her to that next level of blessed. So I know that you, as a medical consultant, were able to look in on some of the great miracle reports as they were attributed to Saint Kateri. What can you share with us, especially as they propose that beatification miracle?
The beauty of having the Jesuit recordings is that we could see what type of intercessory prayer Kateri was known for among the Native people shortly after her death. And so there was a family in California who knew Kateri's life very well in the late 1960s, early 1970s. And one of the young boys developed a sensory neural hearing loss, complete hearing loss, went completely deaf. And the family prayed to Kateri because restoration of sight and hearing historically seemed to be a prayer that was granted through her intercession. And this young man had a complete and spontaneous cure of his neural hearing loss after his mother had obtained a relic of Kateri and placed it over both of his ears. His parents are still to this day deeply devoted to Kateri. This was the miracle that was used for the beatification. John Paul II waived the second miracle that's usually needed for beatification, because so much had been written about her life, and he declared her life virtuous beyond, that it was credible how virtuous her life was. And the beautiful thing is how things come full circle, and this gentleman who received the gift of that healing, his daughter actually played the violin at Kateri's canonization. So it's beautiful to see how the Holy Spirit works. These canonization processes, they don't, you have rubrics, you have an outline that we follow, but it's really up to the Holy Spirit. There have been so many beautiful healings recently, but also documented over time, over hundreds of years, that were through Kateri's intercession. And the most recent ones have been healings of vision, again, hearing, facial distortion, and things like that. And probably, I think one of the most significant modern-day miracles as far as from a medical perspective is the miracle that was recognized by Rome for her actual canonization. And that was
right. That was a flesh-eating bacteria that that had stopped in its tracks.
Right.
So tell us that story. I believe that was in 2006 with Jake Finkbonner was the boy's name.
Right.
Tell us the story of what happened. How did he contract that disease, and then what transpired there with Kateri's intercession?
Okay. Yeah. The beauty of this is how amazingly clear it was that this was a major medical miracle. Jacob Finkbonner was a little boy. He was playing in the last game of the season, basketball, and he fell at the basketball court and kind of nicked his lower lip on the edge of the basketball hoop. And it was just a little nick. His dad put ice on it. They cleaned it out. He went home. But within 2 days, he was running raging fevers. His face was puffy. His eyes were closed shut. And they went into the emergency room, and the infectious disease doctor right away recognized it as being this flesh-eating bacteria. And then over the next 8 days, this poor young man, his face was just completely destroyed by the bacteria. He had multiple surgeries to debride the wound, trying to stop the infection. He'd been on multiple antibiotics. He was intubated. And the doctors had done everything that they could, and they just were not getting control of this infection. Jacob's father he was a Lummi Indian. His mom is Mexican-American. And their priest, their parish priest, Father Sauer, all started praying fervently to Kateri for her intercession. And they had people praying through Kateri all over the world. Now, on day 8 of his hospitalization, one of the sisters out there was a good friend with Sister Kateri Mitchell, who was then the director for the Tikakwitha Conference, the National Native American Catholic Conference. And she went out to Washington and brought with her a relic of St. Kateri. The family was not being given any options. They were told that the doctors had pretty much done everything they knew to do to stop this infection. He was on life support. He was on major antibiotics. He was hooked up to all the monitors. And, you know, parents never give up hope, but the doctors were at a point where they were, they had nothing else that they could offer this young man. And Sister Kateri went in and the family with the family, and they were all gowned and gloved because, of course, it was, you know, a very contagious disease, and they had to go through all the precautions. And Sister Kateri They had a beautiful little prayer service, and all she could do was kind of tunnel through all of Jacob's dressings and all of the isolation gowns and everything, and place the relic of Kateri on his pillow. And then it's just miraculous. Right at that point in time, his heart rate stabilized, his breathing stabilized, his blood cell count stabilized, the infection stopped spreading. I mean, it was almost like somebody flipped a switch, and it happened just like that. And then it was this beautiful, you know, this little boy who was about to be put on some sort of palliative therapy, palliative care, all of a sudden everything turned around.
Amazing.
You know, he still had to go through many major surgeries for plastic surgery and corrective, but the illness that was miraculously cured and it was complete and spontaneous was the fact that this infection completely disappeared.
That's absolutely incredible. That is the miracle healing of Jake Finkbonner, the boy who was cured from that condition, and that is what led to the canonization of St. Kateri Tekakwitha, whose feast day is coming up on July 4th, 14th. And as we wrap up the interview today, we've been talking with Dr. Mary Soha, medical consultant and expert in that canonization cause for St. Kateri. How can we best turn to St. Kateri for her intercession? What are the things that she's known for that she might be both a good model for us, even in our modern age, even though she lived so many years ago? How can she be a good model for us, and what can we turn to for intercession?
Well, I think these holy people travel in gangs in heaven, and her life so parallels the life of St. Thérèse of Lisieux. They both lost their mothers at age 4. They both had what could have been a terminal illness at age 4. They both lived their life in this beautiful, you know, sanctity, trying to be better. They both were ostracized by people within their own spiritual communities. And they both died at age 24. Huh. And so when you study St. Thérèse of Lisieux's spirituality, and she's obviously more contemporary, but you look at St. Kateri, the depth of their prayer life, the simplicity with which they lived their life, the strength with which they bore falsehoods, you know, spread against them and were accused of things that they didn't commit and were totally misunderstood because of their sanctity, or people were jealous of their sanctity. When you look at how this young lady never took her eyes off the cross, that she had the courage to continue to love, that she had the clarity of faith that gave her that energy to continue to love, it's just amazing.
Yes, absolutely. What an amazing saint, someone that we can all turn to for her intercession and inspiration. And we're so grateful to you, Dr. Mary Soha, for joining us today, reflecting on the life of St. Kateri and telling us about some of those incredible miracles that were worked through her intercession and validated by Rome, leading to her being declared a saint.
And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio. Check out the audio archives or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dr. Mary Soha, talking to us about the St. Kateri Tekakwitha medical miracle, and also Father Peter Mangum talking to us about the Shreveport martyrs. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions, the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.